May it please the court, this appeal involves the application, I suppose, of the 18 Del C-6853, which is the medical malpractice statute and the exceptions thereto for three very, very egregious type of conduct, wrong organ, fire, and leaving a foreign object in the body. In those instances, the legislature has said you don't need an expert witness. Negligence is presumed, it's manifest, and there's a rebuttable inference that there was negligence. This case involves one of those wrong organ cases. Mrs. Freeman was needed a liver biopsy, and she went to Dr. Ryan, and he set out to do a liver biopsy, but it turns out that what he really did was a kidney biopsy. There were four tissue samples that he took from what he thought was a liver, but was the kidney, and all four tissue samples were kidney samples, kidney tissue. None of the four samples were liver tissue. So he obviously did a biopsy on the wrong organ. So the issue, of course, is, was this a surgical procedure? And I think that it's clear that it was. The lower court said it clearly was. You invaded the body. You stuck a needle in there. You took tissue out. Dr. Ryan, admitted that it was a surgical procedure, although later on he talks about, well, somatics. He dances around that. His expert, Dr. Wildes, also agreed that it was akin to a arthroscopic surgery where they just simply don't really cut open the body, just insert some type of a needle to take out what they need to take out. And, of course, that's a surgical procedure. So it seems to me that...
Well, if there's damage to another organ during a surgical procedure, does that automatically mean that the damage to another organ is a surgical procedure as well?
No, I guess it depends on really what the surgical procedure would be. If you're talking about damage only, that is cutting, lacerating, burning as in Williams, lacerating as in Russell. I don't think that's a surgical proceeding because cutting, burning is not a surgical procedure. However, in this case, it was not simply nicking of the kidney. It was not simply even taking maybe one sample of the kidney. It was the entire surgical procedure of getting biopsy, all four samples, came from the kidney. So it was not a cutting or a lacerating or harming or whatever. It was the procedure was done on the wrong organ. It was done on the biopsy. Now, I suppose one could argue, for example, in Williams, where they were talking about burning this tubal burning that they were doing. I suppose in Williams, one could argue that if there's such a procedure as burning the bowel, because that's what happened in that case, was the bowel that was burned, I suppose you could say, well, all right, he was supposed to burn the tubes, but he burned the bowel, so that would be a surgical procedure, but there is no such thing as burning the bowel, so there is no such procedure, if I'm answering Your Honor's question. So this is not one of those cases where you simply cut, injured, damaged, nick a different organ. This is a case where you literally do a biopsy, a surgical procedure on the wrong organ. And I don't know how else you can explain it. I mean, that's the only way you can explain it. Once you get over that hurdle and you say, well, this is a surgical procedure, it's a surgical procedure on the wrong organ, then you have the statute that says it's negligence. At least it's an inference of negligence that could be, I suppose, probably rebutted, but it's rebutted by the jury. I mean, if you need an expert you don't need an expert to file a suit, that's clear. You don't need an expert, period, because it's presumed. Then why would you need an expert in the middle of the trial, at the end of the plaintiff's case, or the end of the state's case? I mean, you just emasculate the whole thing. I mean, you haven't gained anything. What has the legislature gained if it says, well, all right, you know, you don't need an expert, but somewhere along the line you're going to need an expert. Obviously, the jury must decide whether the presumption has been rebutted. The jury could have decided against the plaintiff in this case. The jury never got a chance. In fact, and what is interesting, really, I guess, is that the lower court...
Would you ever need an expert to counter the rebuttal expert or the doctor's expert in any circumstance?
No, not if you fit under the statute. You would never need an expert. Now, again, the jury can decide that we haven't proven our case, not because there's no expert, but because they've established that it was not negligent. But you cannot need an expert and still be in compliance with the statute, because then what's the reason for the statute? What's the purpose for the statute if you don't need an expert anyway?
I mean, but as I understand your argument, you don't need an expert. If the other side comes in with an expert, you still get to take your case to the jury.
Yes, because you don't need an expert.
I mean, no, I understand, but I raise that because the Superior Court seemed to have an alternative holding. And the alternative holding seemed to be, if you're right, this is a surgical procedure, and you're right, it's on the wrong organ, and you're correct, you don't need an expert, I, the Superior Court judge, am not letting it go to the jury anyway, because based on the defense, not only have they rebutted the presumption, they've completely taken any triable issue of fact away from the jury. Therefore, as a matter of law, you lose. That's what they said. And your position is no, that's a jury question on whether the defense expert was so compelling.
That is correct. But let me also give you a plan B type of argument, which is that
If I'm giving you plan A and you win, why would you want to go to plan B?
Just in case you don't agree with plan A. but the plan B argument is that even if you say that you need, not necessarily an expert, but that the expert has demolished your case, in this case, the expert did not demolish the case. Because in this case, the expert, in two instances, made it quite clear that, well, three instances really, because first of all, he said in thousands of cases, this has never happened to him or anybody else. So it's not like a standard complication. But more importantly, he said, when he was asked, well, how do you account for this migration and this breeding? Because that's their argument, that the needle migrated. He said, well, I account for it. I look at it. I study. And I said, that works. I have it in the brief here. And he said, yes, that works. And I never had a problem. So if it worked for him, why didn't it work for Dr. Ryan? And the second thing that he said was, I said, well, couldn't you use the ultrasound again if you had any doubts or any questions or just to make sure? He said, yes, of course you could. You could put the ultrasound back on and make sure that you're in the right organ. Why didn't Dr. Ryan do that? So even if you say, well, an expert can demolish your case, this expert did not. So it seems to me, frankly, that what the court says at the summary judgment motion, when everything is equal, I mean, at the summary judgment motion, we say, look, we have no expert, they have an expert, it's all presented, the court says it's denied. I mean, at that point, if an expert is needed, then he would say, well, an expert is needed, you don't have one. But, of course, the court said, no, an expert is not needed. At the end of plaintiff's case, of course, the court actually said that he would have dismissed this at the end of the plaintiff's case also, which, of course, takes away from this expert thing because he's really saying you need an expert anyway. And he said, but I also dismiss at the end of the state's case. So the court erred in thinking that an expert was needed, but even if it's ruled that it was needed or not needed, even if it's ruled that the expert demolished your case, then there was enough evidence to get the jury. And I do think that in a case such as this, I mean, we hold these doctors in this special pedestal, which, you know, I guess legislature has said that's what we do. But the legislature has also said, but there are these three exceptions. And this court and other courts, I mean, have said very clearly that these exceptions are to be applied broadly. In one of the cases, for example, that was cited as Morrow, I mean, they were talking about extended it to even the person who did the reading of the MRI well, not even do the reading. He actually supervised the reading, and I think when the lower court said, yes, that falls into place because we applied this broadly. Well, how can you, you know, how can you fit this in? You apply this exception broadly, but yet in a case that is clear, common sense clearly would tell you that if you're going to do a biopsy of the liver and you wind up with a biopsy of the kidney, something went wrong. I mean, they say, well, it's inadvertent, but inadvertent means negligent.
Let me make sure I understand your argument, Mr. Romano. I understand the rebuttable presumption. If we accept that it's surgery, we accept that it's the wrong organ, you get to file your complaint, you get to begin your case. At the end of your case, you've created a rebuttable presumption of negligence. When the defense comes on and has an expert testify about the requisite standard of care that would apply, and then testifies that the actions that are conceded to have occurred here do not breach that standard of care, and you don't have an expert that differs with the standard of care and differs with whether or not factually there's a breach of that standard of care, how does it get to the jury?
Because the statute says that there's an inference of negligence there, and it is rebuttable.
The statute says it's a rebuttable presumption that there's negligence. When the defense offers an expert that rebuts that presumption, and then the ball comes back across the net, and the audience or the crowd looks at you to see if you return serve, and it's a whiff, there's nothing to return.
Well,
where does that leave us?
Well, if the court is going to rule that you need an expert because they have an expert, then you've simply emasculated the statute.
Well, does it require that you that a court rule that you must have an expert? What the law says is you get into court with your complaint, you get to trial to make your case, and you have on your side this presumption that there's negligence because there was surgery on the wrong organ. All of that gets you before the jury to put on your case. But then that statute contemplates turning to the other side and giving the other side a chance to rebut that presumption. If the mechanism that the other side uses to rebut that presumption is to call an expert that says, yes, we concede all of these facts, but under these circumstances, this is the standard of care that would apply to this doctor's actions, and in my expert opinion, based on these facts, he did not breach that standard of care. Now, where does that leave you? You don't have anyone to say, A, that expert's adoption of a standard of care is incorrect, that's not the requisite standard of care, and B, he's got his facts wrong. The fact is, this was a breach of that standard of care. How does the jury understand how the presumption's been rebutted and how you come back at that alleged rebutted presumption?
Well, a couple of things. But first of all, it is common sense that doing a biopsy or surgical procedure with the wrong organ is negligence. I mean, the jury doesn't need an expert. It's common sense. But if the court's going to rule that you need an expert at that point, then what good is it? Because I mean, if you're going to need an expert anyway, then you might as well not even bother filing the lawsuit. Because you're going to be an expert. I mean, what have you gained? The same expert that gives you the affidavit of merit is going to be used by you. So if you don't need an affidavit of merit to file a lawsuit, you gain nothing. All they've done is invited you to file a lawsuit.
What does the term rebuttable presumption mean to you?
Okay. That's the next point I was going to make, Your Honor. We don't have any cases dealing with this statute and interpretation. This may be the first case where the court says rebuttable presumption can be rebutted by an expert. If that's the ruling, then, of course, that's the ruling. But we do have cases dealing with res ipsa loquitur cases, situations, where in the res ipsa loquitur situation, many of the cases talk about, really, it can be rebutted. And when there's a few cases that talk about rebutting, it's where you completely destroy the evidence, just completely destroy. There's no way the jury could find against you. Or they talk about clear and convincing in some cases. As I, in response to Justice Holland's question, I don't believe this expert completely destroyed the case. I don't think it was clear or convincing.
Well, but by that,
so, I mean, if you, I'm sorry.
By that, do you mean he didn't rebut the presumption?
That's right. He didn't rebut the presumption completely because, as I said, there were two ways that he said he would have done it, and that would have obviously been perfectly fine that Dr. Ryan could have done. So, first of all, I think the court should rule, and I think the statute requires a ruling, that if you're an expert to file a suit, you're an expert, period. Otherwise, why bother? But if the court were to say, all right, you're an expert to file a suit, but then you still don't get there unless you can, you know, rebut, I mean, let's phrase it differently. The inference of presumption or rebuttable inference of negligence cannot be destroyed unless there is, first of all, I don't think it can be destroyed at all, period, because the statute says that.
Even though 304C2, the language of the rules of evidence?
Right, but don't you think, I mean, the statute is going to overcome the rules of evidence? I mean, the statute says you don't need an expert.
Well, the language of that is, unless evidence has been produced which will destroy the inference of negligence on his part or so completely contradict it that the jury could not reasonably accept it. Is that the test that we should apply?
I don't think so. I think that when you have a statute that says in order to proceed with a malpractice case, you need an expert. But this says, provided, however, that when you have these things, you have a rebuttable inference of negligence, that statute is saying you don't need an expert.
So the rule of law that you're asking for is whenever there is a rebuttable presumption, the case always goes to the jury.
Yes, that's a rule of law that I'm asking for. But if that's not the court's ruling, in this case, there was not enough evidence to rebut it, completely destroy it, completely make it impossible for a jury to find it because there was evidence.
Is that because of the acknowledgement about the breathing of the patient?
And the ultrasound. Those two things could have been done very easily. And also the fact that thousands and thousands of these things were done by all these doctors and this never occurred. I mean, it's not an usual complication. It's apparently everybody can do it properly for thousands of ways, except this one time he made a mistake. You know, he inadvertently did it.
Do you want to save the last 2.5 minutes for
yes,
rebuttal?
Yes, thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, opposing counsel. The general rule on medical negligence cases in Delaware is that you need an expert because it involves some degree of specialized knowledge. The legislature enacted some very narrow exceptions to that general rule, which is in the same language of the statute 6853. Those narrow exceptions are cases where you leave the wrong foreign object in, there's a fire, or where there's a surgical procedure on the wrong organ. Talking about the standard of care, it doesn't necessarily address the negative result where the law is in Delaware that an unfortunate outcome is not evidence of negligence. In this case, the undisputed evidence was that Dr. Ryan, who's not a surgeon and interventional radiologist, did the correct procedure. The patient was scheduled for a liver biopsy. A liver biopsy is done through the side under ultrasound guidance. There's an initial ultrasound where he can see where the needle goes in. And in fact, in this case, there is a CD which shows the needle is actually in the liver. Because it's a sterile field, he then has to set down the ultrasound and uses instruments in order to get a sample of tissue. In this case, there was a migration, not through negligence, but because there are complications that can occur. And also because in this patient's unique status, she had what's called a Riedel's lobe, which is an abnormal anatomy where the liver is a little bit thinner. When the results came back, he found out that it was the non-target tissue.
That was known in advance of the procedure?
It was known after the procedure. The results came back 2 months later.
This unusual condition that she had.
It was not. It is not something that you could necessarily detect. It was only later determined when they looked at a CAT scan, which was done, and showed that there was this Riedel's lobe there. The procedure of doing a liver biopsy, which is what my client did, is a completely different procedure than doing a kidney biopsy.
Well, you know, I read that in your brief many times, and I have to tell you I'm confused. You seem to be suggesting that because the point of entry was the point of entry for a liver biopsy, and it wasn't the point of entry for a kidney biopsy, that by definition, a liver biopsy was done strictly based on the point of entry, and it completely disregards the fact that there was no liver tissue recovered. The only tissue recovered was from the kidney. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Is that what you're saying? That by definition, he did a liver biopsy because he entered the way you would enter for a liver biopsy, and he didn't enter the way you would enter for a kidney biopsy?
Yes, sir. And the distinction is this: if the purpose of the statute is to analyze the standard of care, it's the actions of the physician in performing the procedure that determine whether there's a breach or there's not a breach, not necessarily the result. And some examples that I would use are
I read that in your brief too, and I'm still confused. If you biopsied the kidney, which is what happened in this case. That was not the intention, but that was the result, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
So we have an unintended biopsy of the kidney. Nevertheless, you continue to describe this as a liver biopsy.
Because the...
Well, just tell me if I'm right so far.
You are, yes, sir, you are correct.
Okay.
I mean, there is the tissue obtained was non-target tissue. He did not intend to get kidney tissue. He intended to get liver tissue. Because of breathing, because of this anomaly, he got non-target tissue. But that was not his intention, and that was not the procedure that he intended to perform.
I agree.
I don't dispute.
The record's clear.
Yeah.
But let's suppose he had intended to do a kidney biopsy. That was his intention. He would have recovered something like the samples we have in this case. Is that right?
Yes, although it would have been a different procedure, but the result would have been the same.
So we have the results of a kidney biopsy, even though he intended to do a liver biopsy.
We do, yes. But I would make the point that the standard of care is not determined by the result or the outcome.
I understand your argument completely. Let me ask you a question about this rebuttable presumption, and you may want to backtrack about why the presumption doesn't apply at all. But for the purpose of my question, if we do have a rebuttable presumption, and either the judge or the jury concludes it's been rebutted, have they made a factual determination that it's been rebutted? Based on what's been presented?
No, Your Honor. They've made a legal determination that the evidence is insufficient to go to the jury. If you just applied the statute like Mr. Ramuno.
No, I just want to focus on this distinction because you're exactly right. And my focus is when you conclude the presumption has been rebutted, there are legal consequences. But do you do that by making a factual determination that the evidence presented has rebutted it, or is it a conclusion of law?
My position would be that that's a conclusion of law under Rule 50 that is made by every trial court at the close of the case if there's a motion made by the defendant that the evidence is insufficient to go to the jury. So it is a legal determination of whether the evidence before the court is sufficient that a reasonable jury could conclude that there is sufficient evidence to go to the jury.
So that means that there can be no evidence from which a rational juror could conclude there was negligence. That's the standard, right?
Yes. And may I elaborate on that point a little bit? And I do want to backtrack because I want to make my other points. The example was made of the res ipsa loquitur, which has clearly been rejected by the courts as applicable to the Med-Mal statutes because they said there's just these exceptions. So I would say that that standard doesn't apply. But if you looked at the res ipsa loquitur standard, it talks about items going to the jury within ordinary human experience. The difficulty in a medical malpractice type case is that the evidence that's being presented is not within the ordinary understanding of the jury. So now we're asking a jury to speculate or conclude based upon a lack of an expert on the plaintiff's side to make a determination as to whether the doctor, in fact, breached the standard of care, which was the proximate cause of injuries, or not. So it's in my estimation, that's the difficulty of applying the res ipsa loquitur standard to the exceptions that are put forth in the statute.
Now, does that apply only to a determination of what is the correct standard of care and whether or not there's been a breach? Because it strikes me Mr. Ramuno would respond to what you just said by saying, well, wait a minute, what's outside the province of the jury to understand if the intent was to take tissue from the liver and the result was taking tissue from a kidney, a different organ? What kind of scientist does it take to understand there's a difference between the liver and the kidney?
I agree on the result that was obtained. It's not necessarily difficult for the jury to understand that. But as to whether the techniques, the process, and the mechanisms by which that doctor used or did that procedure, I mean, the issue the jury is deciding is not whether there was a negative result. The issue the jury decides in a medical malpractice case is whether the physician, by his actions, breached the standard of care. And I would suggest if we adopted a standard by which it was a negative result, there is contrary law to the, I mean, if you read the jury instruction on medical negligence, it says an unfortunate result is not evidence of negligence.
Well, doesn't the statute mean, though, that in circumstances where you perform surgery on the wrong organ, that creates a rebuttable presumption that you've breached the standard of care? And this case could then go to the jury where the jury has two factors in front of it. First, that there was surgery done on the wrong organ, and whether or not the evidence offered by the defense suggests that that presumption of negligence has been overcome by their own expert's description of the standard of care and opinion that it has not been breached. Isn't that ultimately the jury's role to weigh those two factors and see which is correct?
It is not necessarily, and I'm trying to answer the question, not necessarily the jury's role, because if you take that position, then, you know, Rule 50 and motions for a directed verdict and overcoming the presumption mean nothing.
Mr. Ramuno says, and we can try to reconcile the rules and the statute, Mr. Ramuno's position is fairly straightforward. We have limited exceptions where you don't need an expert. Those limited exceptions create a rebuttable presumption. And that should get you to the jury. If the rebuttable presumption is extinguished by the defense presentation of an expert, which means the plaintiff now needs an expert, then the statute really doesn't provide for any exceptions, because a plaintiff is never going to get to the jury without an expert. That's what he told us.
And let me just suggest some practicalities in that. In the case where there's a fire or a foreign object, or where the physician intends, you know, he's supposed to operate on the left arm and he operates on the right arm, those are the narrow exceptions that this statute was meant to address. In the vast majority of those cases, the defense is never going to be able to present a plausible expert to defend the standard of care. The statute is not intended to say that in all cases, because medicine is a unique science, that you can't present evidence in defense. And I would suggest, under circumstances like this case, where there has been undisputed evidence by the defendant doctor from the time he was deposed, that the plaintiffs were on notice that they would eventually need an expert. In fact, they filed a motion at one point in time to attempt to get an expert and then withdrew that. And then when the defense presents an expert, that uncontradicted evidence shows that the defendant doctor met the standard of care, now the only evidence in the case is that the defendant doctor met the standard of care.
Well, is that really accurate? Because, and I hope you at some point you're going to focus on the open questions Mr. Romano asked in his reply brief, because he quotes your expert's discussion about the breathing, and you watch the breathing, and then you make your estimates so that where you do not have the biopsy done on the liver as opposed to the kidney. And how do you manage then to do this without thousands of cases never having a problem? I watch them. I try to guesstimate when it is. That really works. You watch them, you estimate it, and it really works. Correct. And Mr. Romano argues the jury could ask, why didn't the defendant do this? Why didn't he watch the breathing? Is this evidence, particularly with this particular focus on the breathing, sufficient to completely destroy the inference that the statute allows?
Absolutely. And the reason is because there was no issue that Dr. Widlis on the stand said that Dr. Ryan met the standard of care. I mean, that was never disputed. The fact that a attorney may cross-examine an expert on some point, but there was absolutely no point during that examination that Dr. Widlis said anything but that Dr. Ryan met the standard of care.
Well, doesn't this suggest the standard of care includes watching the breathing of the patient and then doing a estimate so that you do not puncture another organ?
But there's no evidence in this case that Dr. Ryan failed to do that. What we're doing is attempting to say because he got an unfortunate result, that means he breached the standard of care. But there's no evidence in the case that he breached the standard of care. Dr. Widlis, I would suggest if you read the totality of his testimony, clearly says that Dr. Ryan met the standard of care.
Let's assume that's correct. But where does credibility come in and the jury's role in assessing credibility? As you know, we have workman's compensation cases, and we have other cases where it's basically dueling experts. And we say many times, you know, the Industrial Accident Board or the jury can accept one expert's testimony over the other expert's testimony. It's a credibility assessment. We, you know, defer to the trier of fact. What you're saying in this case is the jury wasn't free to reject the testimony of your expert. And my question is, why is that the law?
Okay. Because in this, the context of this medical negligence case, where we're dealing with, usually it's dueling experts and credibility becomes a major issue. There is no expert for the plaintiff to weigh the credibility of the defense expert.
Exactly,
against.
And that's why the duel here is the presumption created by the statute versus your expert.
Right.
And what you're saying is my expert is able to completely engulf and overwhelm the presumption because my expert said the defendant doctor did nothing wrong.
Yes, but when you've destroyed the inference and you've rebutted that, and I would argue it's a 301, not a 304, we met the burden of rebutting that inference. That inference is gone. Now the plaintiffs have to come forward with evidence.
Just one more question. But you only rebut it if the trier of fact believes you've rebutted it. Is that correct?
It is a matter of law that the evidence is insufficient. And Judge Tolliver did say I wanted to hear the expert, you know, to sort of hear the evidence because he didn't rule on summary judgment. This is really akin to if you look at the Russell versus Kanga case and the other case I cite in my brief, where you're performing a procedure and you inadvertently get another procedure. You're performing a tubal and you get a little piece of bowel. Or in the case of the urologic procedures where they were doing the hysterectomy and they inadvertently nicked the bladder. Those were cases where those were not surgical procedures on the wrong organ. There was no intent under that Williams versus Dyer case to perform that. I would argue that that analysis is applicable here, and we shouldn't even address whether the inference applies, because in my first argument would be that the statute doesn't apply because this was not a surgery on the wrong organ. I mean, we can debate about whether this is a surgical procedure. It's not a surgeon. It's not an incision. It's not repairing something within. It's more of a diagnostic procedure, like an IV, drawing blood. And if you read and put it in context of the totality of the exceptions, this doesn't necessarily fit it. And
so you're maintaining the position that this was not a surgical procedure?
Yes, Your Honor.
What would you say to the fact that the 2008 current procedural terminology developed by the AMA for billing purposes places liver biopsies under the general heading surgery, digestive system, liver incision?
Right. Well, the evidence presented at this case was that it wasn't a surgical procedure in the general context of how a surgery is presumed, and gray areas are developing in medicine where there's all of these interventions.
But you can bill it as a surgery, the AMA says.
Well, that may be. I didn't know that was part of the evidence in the case, and I'm not disputing
Well, the question in my mind was going to ask you was, it's clearly not part of the record, but it is part of the world of research. Is it something that we're allowed to look at and consider in addressing the question of whether this is a surgical procedure or not? The AMA defining it as one. Is it any different looking in the dictionary to define a word?
I don't know that that's necessarily different. I think if there was definitions which were part of determining whether it was a surgical procedure, it would be within the court's purview to do that. But if that was something I wish the trial court we maybe could have addressed a little broader when it was in front of Judge Tolliver. But even if you say it's a surgical procedure, is it a surgical procedure on the wrong organ? I mean, this Williams versus Dyer suggests that you got to have an intent. He clearly intended to do a liver biopsy.
All right,
I see my
just,
time's concluded.
One question. Let's assume that there was an expert witness for the plaintiff, and the expert witness said that what was done here was a surgical procedure was performed on the wrong organ. Just the words right out of the statute. And your doctor testifies as he did. Would the case go to the jury then?
I think if there was expert testimony on both sides, the case would go to the jury.
Even if the expert only says what's in the statute?
I think he would have to say it was a breach of the standard of care or explain the basis as to why it was a breach of the standard of care.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pardon. Just briefly, the defendant in this case argues and has argued throughout that a negative result is not proof of negligence, and which is correct in the standard case, but this is not the case here. It is the negative result which makes the statute applicable. The statute says if you have a result, fire, leave something in, foreign object, or wrong organ, that's the result. That result, negligence, or at least the rebuttable inference of negligence or presumption of negligence. So that rule obviously has been overridden by the statute that says the negative result gives you the presumption. And obviously, once you have the negative result, it is egregious enough that the statute says that's negligence. And a jury can easily, common sense tells you, wrong organ is negligence. Fire is negligence. I mean, I suppose, frankly, that when he says, well, if you cut the wrong arm, they can't really bring any evidence in. Of course you can. An expert, the doctor, in this mysterious world that we have of doctors, and only doctors know, doctor could say, well, in our mysterious world, if the nurse says, you know, A or B, or she drapes the wrong arm, then he's not negligent. Because, you know, I mean, there's a lot of ways that an expert could do this. But the statute says the jury, you cannot do that. And Williams and Russell are completely inapplicable. And the logic is inapplicable, is not logical in Williams. The reasoning is illogical. But in any event, Williams is a burning of the bowel, not a surgical procedure. Russell is the laceration of the bladder, not a surgical procedure. This is a complete and total surgical procedure for tissues of the kidney. That is the biopsy. That's
so
a surgical
kidney
procedure.
Has been damaged, but no tissue removed.
Pardon me? No,
if
I'm
the
sorry.
Kidney had been damaged, but no tissue had been removed.
Then I would have argued that I would not be here, because I would have agreed that if they nicked the kidney, it would not be a surgical procedure. But if they did the surgical procedure on the kidney as compared to the liver, as they did, that's a surgical procedure on the wrong organ. And intent, by the way, is obviously no one is going to intend to do the wrong procedure. It's always obviously going to be unintentional. If it was intentional, it would be criminal.
Now, do you have a definition for us of a surgical procedure?
I think I did in my brief.
All right.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask both counsel, do you agree that this is a case of first impression, the first time this statute has been poised for interpretation in context?
I agree, Your Honor.
I agree with that in the context of the rebuttable inference.
Okay.
There are two cases that have dealt with it outside of that as to whether it applies.
All right. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Thank you, Brian.